This walking tour is brought to you by Dr. Richard Grimsley, a fellowship-trained joint replacement surgeon affiliated with the Riverside Division of Jacksonville Orthopedic Institute. Dr. Grimsley wants you to know that if you want to stay off his operating table, you should get out and get walking.
Hello and welcome to Riverside Avondale Preservation's inaugural audio tour. Today we'll be exploring a small slice of historic Riverside. A few housekeeping details first. The tour covers about 2 miles and will end with an easy walking distance of where we've started. It will last anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, depending on whether you listen straight through or pause the tour frequently. At various points in the tour, you'll hear a bell. If you've got a video-enabled MP3 player, that bell signals there's a photo on your screen related to whatever we're discussing. Feel free to pause the tour at any time if you need to catch up or want to linger at a particular stop.
Our tour today begins at one of the most modern developments in the Riverside area, the Riverside Arts Market. Since it opened in 2009, the market has brought tremendous vitality and tons of visitors to our area. But you already know that because you're one of them. We're going to take a left at the top of the market and walk down Riverside Avenue towards Memorial Park, where the tour will officially begin. As you stroll along the 6-block section of Riverside Avenue with its many nondescript office buildings, you'll need to use your imagination to envision the stunning homes built by some of Jacksonville's wealthiest families that once lined this road.
At the turn of the last century, there were 50 large mansions on this street. Sadly, only 2 of them remain. Just as you approach Memorial Park, you'll see those 2 houses on the left corner of Riverside and Lancaster Street. One, a large shingle-style residence built in 1901 for turpentine magnate William J. Kelly, now operates as an elegant bed and breakfast. The other, a large yellow brick house designed for Robert Stringfellow, the president of a wholesale grocery firm, is now a medical office. You can see pictures of the many grand homes the neighborhood has lost at Riverside Avondale Preservation's booth at RAM. Be sure to check them out when you're done with the tour.
On your left, you'll pass the Cumber Museum of Art and Gardens, one of Jacksonville's hidden gems. It's built on the site of what was once the Cumber family compound. The family's patriarch, Wellington Cumber, was the largest landowner in Florida at the turn of last century. There were 3 homes on the site, one for Mr. Cumber, another owned by his son Waldo, and the third by son Arthur, whose wife Nina's art collection formed the nucleus to the Cumber Museum's impressive holdings. Nina's ornate Italianate gardens are still intact behind the museum building and ranked as one of the city's must-see stops. So enjoy your stroll down Riverside Avenue and pause your player until you reach Memorial Park. As you enter Memorial Park, walk along the tree-lined path nearest the street, proceeding toward the northwestern corner of the park at the intersection of Margaret Street and Riverside Avenue. This lovely park is one of our city's most iconic places. On any given day, it's full of dogs and children playing frisbee. Across the street, along the road leading to the Five Point Shopping District, neighbors relax with a cup of coffee at a cafe table or cross the busy road for a quick bite to eat.
But back in 1901, on the morning of May 3rd, when our story begins, the only sounds you'll hear are songbirds and the river lapping against the shore. There is no park here, only a wide grassy field known as the picnic ground that leads down to a sandy beach. On Sundays, you might also hear the echo of old hymns as a local church congregation baptizes its newest member in the river's tea-stained waters. Up ahead on your right, past the colorful row of Victorian houses along Margaret Street, is one of the city's newest parks, a 14-acre space that was donated to the city in 1893 by John Murray Forbes, a Boston millionaire who first amassed his fortune in the Cantonese opium trade and then became an early railroad investor and landowner. The new Riverside Park has become quite fashionable, although people entering it must do so through a corner turnstile, because a fence has been erected to keep out the cattle that still roam freely throughout this part of the city. Let's cross Margaret Street on your left and begin walking toward the corner of Goodwin Street, one long block away, while we learn a little more about the man behind the park.
In 1869, John Forbes, through his agent Edward M. Cheney, a lawyer and Union Army captain, purchased 500 acres of the southern half of a Spanish land grant known as Dell's Bluff. Most of the land was an old cornfield, part of a plantation that also grew cotton, rice, sugarcane, and sweet potatoes. Forbes platted the farmland into lots and renamed the area Riverside. Then he and Cheney, who by this time had purchased the Union newspaper, which later became the Florida Times Union, built fine riverfront homes and waited for the influx of residents. For more than 2 decades, though, they have the area largely to themselves. However, by 1895, Cheney and Forbes' investment has clearly paid off. Business is booming, with the street trolley connecting residents to downtown, an abundant water supply fed from 7 artesian wells, Riverside has become the city's most desirable residential suburb. Its wealthiest citizens sport electric cars and lavish carriages and take to the river in small motorized yachts for a very pleasant commute to their offices in the city center. By 1901, Commercial Street, the main thoroughfare along which you are walking, has been renamed Riverside Avenue. Although some 2,500 residents live here, the outlying areas are still rural in character. Down the river, the area that will eventually become Avondale remains a favorite place to hunt wild game. But on this warm morning of May 3rd, a tragic event is about to change this quiet enclave and indeed all of Jacksonville.
Around noon today, a spark from a small wood-burning cook stove will set ablaze some of the Spanish moss laid out to dry at the Cleveland Fiber Factory, located at Union and Davis Streets downtown. With the aid of a strong westerly wind, the fire will soon consume the shanties that surround the factory, and the burning debris will jump along hundreds of wood-shingled rooftops that are already dangerously dry after a prolonged drought. In just over 8 hours, the flames will sweep through 146 city blocks, destroying over 2,000 buildings, taking 7 lives, and leaving almost 10,000 people homeless. In the ensuing days, papers will report that the glow from Jacksonville's Great Fire could be seen in Savannah, Georgia, and that its black plume of smoke was visible as far as Raleigh, North Carolina, some 500 miles away. The Confederate Monument in Hemming Plaza will be one of the few structures to survive. Witnesses will marvel that its base glowed red. "There seemed to be nothing left," writes the noted journalist H.L. Mencken in the Baltimore Sun, "save a fringe of houses around the municipal periphery, like hair on a friar's head." The citizens of Jacksonville, determined to rebuild their devastated city, begin its reconstruction at a breathtaking pace. Indeed, the embers are still smoldering when 3 days from now, Rudolph Grunthal applies for the first building permit in the burned area. As soon as the debris in the streets cool, it's hauled to the river to form bulkheads. Within 5 months, more than 1,000 building permits will be issued, and a good percentage of the new homes, some of the finest to rise from the ashes of old Jacksonville, will be built right here.
Within a few years, the clatter of construction will be unmistakable. Rarely does a city get the opportunity to start from scratch, but Jacksonville is now an empty canvas. Thousands of building tradesmen will travel here to aid the rebuilding effort, and the area will become a proving ground for aspiring architects and the diverse residential styles they promote. Wealthy and well-established families leave the burned-out areas of downtown and build large, elegant homes along Riverside Avenue, known locally as The Row. The section of Riverside between roughly Forest and Goodwin Streets will gain a national reputation as one of the most beautiful streets in America.
If you've reached Goodwin, bring yourself back to the 21st century and take a look at the corner where Publix is. Then take a left and head toward the river. On that site once stood one of the most architecturally significant buildings in Riverside. Designed by Henry J. Clutho, perhaps the preeminent architect to come to Jacksonville after the fire, the house at 2059 Riverside had a masonry base supporting a red brick first story and a white stucco upper story. This architectural style, now familiar as the Prairie School, was a radical movement in American architecture being championed by Chicago architect Louis Sullivan and his chief draftsman, an eccentric aesthete named Frank Lloyd Wright. The Prairie School architects sought to develop a purely American architecture, using sweeping horizontal lines as a metaphor for the democratic frontier spirit of the Midwest Plains. Clutho recognized that the prairie style, with its broad overhanging eaves and extensive windows providing natural shade and ventilation, was well suited to Jacksonville's climate. The house at 2059 Riverside, built for Mr. George W. Clark, established a regional variation of the Prairie School so widely emulated that Jacksonville today has more major examples of the Prairie School style than anywhere outside the Midwest. It also has lost more great prairie-style buildings than any other city, with the exception, perhaps, of Chicago.
The now-defunct Riverside Hospital purchased the George Clark property in 1979 and tore down the home for hospital expansion. As we stroll through this section of Riverside, known as the St. John's Quarter, you'll see many prairie-style homes, but you'll also see Jacobean, Mediterranean, Colonial, and Georgian Revival styles. In other parts of Riverside, you'll see variations on the shingle style, Queen Anne, Gothic Revival, and even Art Deco architecture. This is another of the Great Fire's legacies, the infusion of craftsmen and architects, when combined with the upper-middle-class resources of the area's residents, left Riverside Avondale with the largest variety of architectural styles in the state.
When you reach the end of Goodwin Street, at the intersection with River Boulevard, turn and stand with your back to the river.
On the left corner is one of the oldest and most interesting buildings in the city. It's also Riverside's only example of the Second Empire style. We're going to pause here for a few minutes because there's so much to discuss. Built sometime in the 1860s and originally located in the Brooklyn neighborhood, near where the Times Union building is today, what was then called Rochester House was barged up the river to its present location in 1911. In earlier years, it was a resort hotel surrounded by lush gardens and a grove of orange trees with steps leading down to the river. Today, even though the house's two-story verandas have been enclosed and its widow walk removed, many of the original distinctive features remain, including wooden coins, bracketed eaves, and the mansard roof.
There are multiple references to Rochester House in early post-Civil War tourist guides of the area. One book identifies it as one of the best lodgings in Jacksonville, with rooms available for between $2 and $3 a day. This makes the building a rare relic from Jacksonville's heyday as the nation's premier winter resort. Most of the large downtown hotels, including some very large and impressive ones, burned down in the Great Fire. Equally fascinating are the stories associated with the house. The widow of President Lincoln visited Jacksonville in late 1874, one of many health tourists who flocked to the area for its climate. Contemporary references say she was a guest here. Fellow boarders noted her insistence on keeping the window shades pulled down and lighting her rooms only with candles, claiming gaslight was the tool of the devil. Historians cite this as the onset of Mary Todd Lincoln's famous insanity phase, during which she became unwaveringly convinced that her son Robert was deathly ill. Evidently, neither the warm climate nor the seclusion did Mary much good. She left Jacksonville in March 1875 for Chicago, and by May of that year had been committed to an insane asylum.
What is now an apartment building known as the River House also reputedly houses the ghost of a long-departed guest. According to Tom Boaz, who lived in the River House with his mother in the 1960s, many residents reported seeing a pretty young blonde woman with a long black dress of an old-fashioned or Civil War style. One gentleman spoke of seeing something or someone suddenly appearing by the fireplace mantel and then vanishing within an instant. He was so unnerved by the sight that he fled the Boaz apartment and didn't return for months. The story Tom heard from an old caretaker on the property was that the ghost was the young bride of a Confederate blockade runner who built the house for her as a wedding present. When he later died at sea, the bride was so saddened that she pined away and expired soon after. It's true that for a short period during the Civil War, Jacksonville served as a crossroads for Confederate blockade runners. Because of its secure port and warehouse facilities and its connection to railroads, the city was a key supply point for hogs and cattle leaving Florida and aiding the Confederate cause. However, the rest of the caretaker's story is almost impossible to verify. To this day, we're not really sure who built the house. Still, those who believe in ghosts should look more closely at River House's third story. It is there, say residents, that the ghost's footsteps are most often heard.
On the right, you'll see a distinctive riverfront house that was built in 1924 for Charles Welshins. It was designed by Henrietta Dozier, Jacksonville's first female architect. A graduate of MIT with a strong preference for wearing pants, Dozier was a trailblazer in a profession dominated by men, a feat made all the more impressive when one recalls women weren't even able to vote until 1922. Although Dozier designed many buildings in Jacksonville, including the Federal Reserve Bank building downtown, she thought of this home as one of her most interesting assignments. Describing it to contemporaries, Dozier noted that the house faces the river, is almost pure Georgian in style, and centering the front is a lovely circular stairway which winds gracefully to the second floor. Miss Dozier was scornful of what she deemed fads in architecture and contended, "If you build a house which is in good style at the time and of first-class materials, it is always good." We couldn't agree more. Turn left down River Boulevard and walk along the river. We'll be talking about the houses we pass. Feel free to pause the tour if you want to stop and study them.
The cedar and glass house at 2111 River Boulevard presents a dramatic contrast to its much older neighbor. In city planner parlance, this is considered smart infill construction. The house was built on an underutilized parcel within an established area, and yet in size and scale, managed to blend very well with its early 20th century surroundings. It was designed and built in 1978 by George Fisher, who called it the upside-down house, because its bedrooms are on the first floor, while the second floor's living areas enjoy lovely river views.
The yellow brick building at 2119 River Boulevard was built in 1916. You'll see echoes of the prairie influence in its construction. Note its U-shape, which was common in many apartment buildings of the period because the design facilitated ventilation in the era before air conditioning. Known locally as Mini, this building's floor plan is a duplicate of one at 2126 St. John's Avenue, which neighbors called Gertrude. The two apartment houses are named for the women for whom they were built. The husbands of Minnie and Gertrude wanted to give their wives financial security at a time when few women own property.
Proceed to 2129 River Boulevard, a stucco Mediterranean Revival residence built in 1924. This apartment building, known as the Montague, was named for Montague Terrace, which was the original name for River Boulevard. The Mediterranean Revival style, popularized in Florida by the architect Addison Meisner, is an eclectic style characterized by stucco wall finishes, tile roofs, irregular floor plans, and Italian and Spanish details and decorations. Although the building retains several original architectural elements, including the doorway's cast stone ornaments, the structure fell victim to what many in the preservation community call remodeling. The period windows have been removed and shorter ones have been installed. This altered the building's facade and has muddied its architectural character.
The next home is 2137 River Boulevard. George Olaf Holmes built this charming house in 1922. Holmes was a 39-year-old real estate salesman when he took up the architectural profession in 1901. Raised and educated locally, he became the first president of the Florida Association of Architects. He also served as the city of Jacksonville's treasurer, as well as its police commissioner. Like the nearby river house, this house is purported to be haunted. There's not much information as to who the ghost might be, but the home's occupants report that it's a friendly ghost and it makes its presence known by brushing up against the homeowner's skirts at various times of the day.
The masonry home at 2147 River Boulevard was built in 1925 and is referred to as vernacular design, which means simply that the structure is similar in format to numerous others built in the same time period and general region. Although vernacular architecture doesn't presume to follow any academic architectural style, its varied designs are a reflection of local customs, environment, and building materials, and thus are no less important as artifacts of their era than their more celebrated neighbors.
Moving on to 2165 River Boulevard, you'll find a beautiful buff-colored brick home built in 1912 for G.F. Bensel, who was president of the Southern States Land and Timber Company. The architect was Wilbur B. Talley, who designed the dwelling of feature heavy brackets and wide eaves, which emphasized the house's horizontal lines and create a vaguely oriental flair. On a practical note, the broad overhangs and covered porch also help house's occupants stay cool during the Florida's sweltering summers. The double-hung windows could be lowered from the top down to facilitate airflow, even in the event of a blowing rainstorm. The house is notable for its interior decoration, which includes examples of Rookwood architectural pottery. At the turn of the century, Cincinnati's Rookwood Pottery was the international center for ceramic excellence. Its architectural tile division, specializing in arts and crafts motifs, created custom installations for grand homes, hotels, and public spaces throughout the country, including several of New York City's subway stations. The Great Depression hit the company hard, and the architects could no longer afford Rookwood tiles and mantles. The Bensel House is one of a small number of homes in America that still retains its original Rookwood pottery fireplace.
As you move along River Boulevard to the corner of Copeland Street, you'll come to number 2201. This is another masonry vernacular home built in 1912 by architect-builder Roy Benjamin. The house underwent extensive restoration in the 1990s, and the present owners constructed a private boathouse on the river, whose roofline beautifully mimics the original house.
The large brick home at 2215 River Boulevard, built in the Tudor Revival style, is the second home in the St. John's Quarter designed by our favorite female architect, Henrietta Dozier. Hired by Dr. W. Herbert Adams in 1927, Dozier was duly proud of this home, calling it splendid. Interestingly, she was decidedly not an advocate of widespread home ownership, calling it an unsafe investment for most wage earners. Sadly, in 1929, at the beginning of the Great Depression, Dozier's once brisk practice dwindled to almost nothing, and she lost her own house, which she had designed.
As we walk toward the end of River Boulevard, you'll see numerous pilings in the water. Those are the remnants of a huge private dock that belonged to the Cheek Mansion on the corner. This is the house that's on everyone's list of what to show visitors from out of town. Roy Benjamin created the spectacular Jacobean Revival edifice for coffee magnate Leon T. Cheek, Cheek was one of the 8 sons of Joel Cheek, who had developed a proprietary blend of coffee in Nashville, Tennessee, naming it for the hotel, Maxwell House, where it was originally served. Leon Cheek came to Jacksonville in 1909 to open and manage the Jacksonville plant of what was then known as the Cheek Neal Coffee Company.
It was Leon Cheek who popularized the company's famous slogan, which stems from what some have called the world's most famous sip of coffee. In 1907, President Theodore Roosevelt was visiting the Hermitage, Andrew Jackson's home in Nashville, Tennessee, and was served a cup of Cheek family's Maxwell House blend. After draining his cup, a pleased Theodore Roosevelt reportedly proclaimed it, "Good to the last drop." His actual words are in some dispute. However, an article in the Nashville Banner that ran that evening instead quoted the president as saying, "This is the kind of stuff I like to drink when I hunt bears." In 1928, Cheek sold Maxwell House to the company that would become General Foods for $42 million, half in cash and half in stock. That same year, he commissioned architect Roy Benjamin to design this extraordinary house, which was built in 1929 at a reputed cost of over $100,000. The 11,000-square-foot home rests on 177 copper-capped pilings and features walls that are 2 feet thick. It also boasts a living room as large as a ballroom. The castle-like impression is reinforced by the crenellated tower, numerous Tudor arches, diamond-paned windows, and stone tracery. Note the contrast of the dark brick and the cream-colored masonry trim that frames every opening.
The present owners are only the second occupants of the house, and the family is well known for their active role in the community. For more than 2 decades, scores of local school children were invited to the castle for splendid royal tea parties, complete with child-sized goodies, tables laden with sparkling jewels, and the courtly presence of a richly clad king. The parties were a well-earned reward for those children who'd successfully memorized and recited poems throughout the school year. The present owner still lovingly tends the beautiful gardens, which are enclosed by a spectacular ornamental fence with a 7-foot-tall gate.
As we turn right onto Osceola Street from River Boulevard, look briefly at the riverfront house in the shadow of the Villa Riva condominium tower. The house is a blend of Queen Anne and Colonial Revival architectural styles and was built in 1915 for R.O. Groover. By the 1970s, the house had been turned into a commercial daycare facility for adults with Alzheimer's disease and then sat vacant and neglected for several years before being rescued by the present owners in 2001. The attractive single-family home you see today stands as a testament as to what committed restoration efforts can achieve.
The story of the house's architect, Mellon Greeley, is an interesting one. At the time of the Great Fire, Greeley was just 21 years old and a soldier in Jacksonville's light infantry. Like others that fateful day, he had raced to the river to escape the conflagration and found himself stranded on the Market Street Pier. With roiling water on one side and a sea of fire consuming the land end of the dock on the other, the scene was one of mayhem and panic, with many people getting washed under the wharf as they jumped into the water to avoid the flames. Fortunately, Greeley and some 60 others stranded on the pier were saved when a yacht belonging to Arthur Cummer steamed through the smoke to their rescue. It is Cummer's estate in Riverside that later became the site of the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens. Ironically, the fire proved to be Greeley's making. In its aftermath, he was hired by architect J. H.W. Hawkins as a $5-a-week filing clerk. Greeley soon was promoted to draftsman, and in 1905 he designed his first house, a bungalow that became his own residence, and which still can be seen, albeit heavily remodeled, at 2561 Oak Street. Even though Greeley lacked a degree in architecture, he helped to found the State Board of Architecture to license architects in Florida, and by the time of his death at age 101, had come to be regarded as the dean of Jacksonville's architectural community.
Let's continue walking up Osceola toward Riverside Avenue. On your left, at 1810 Osceola, you'll find a prairie-style house built in 1912 by J.P. Hamilton. The house was originally located at 2030 Riverside and was one of 3 homes built on the river just south of Memorial Park, near where the Park Lane stands today. By the mid-1990s, the 4,500-square-foot house had become badly deteriorated, sporting holes big enough for a bike to drive through. 2 seasoned local restorers decided to save the structure and arranged to have the 220-ton house barged up the river to its current location. This entailed removing and numbering every single brick so that when the house reached its new home, it could be properly constructed. However, the process of putting the old bricks back together again after the move proved too difficult. Instead, they've been repurposed in the walkways and other landscape elements around the property. The structure retains many of its stunning interior features, including mahogany doors and moldings, a grand staircase with hand-carved rosettes, silver fish sconces, and a 5-foot bronze clay pottery fireplace and mantle made by the American Encaustic Tile Company.
The prairie-style home at 1718 Osceola was built by H. B. Snell in 1914 for Edward Cohen. Edward's father was one of the founders of the Cohen Brothers department stores, a name then synonymous with upscale stores that sold the finest fashions and the sturdiest overalls. Just 2 years earlier, Cohen and his brothers had presided over the grand opening of their flagship store, a beautiful downtown emporium designed by Henry J. Glutho that featured, among other services, a hair salon, a hat maker, a lending library, a soda fountain, and a parrot trainer. That stunning building today serves as Jacksonville's City Hall. The house here on Osceola was totally renovated in 1990, and it's currently owner-occupied for use as private residence and bed and breakfast.
Up on the left at 1712 Osceola Street, you'll find the first house actually built in, as opposed to moved to, the St. John's Quarter. This wood-clad frame vernacular residence was constructed for Sigmund Berg in 1912 and was designed by the owner's brother. Sigmund Berg was an executive of the Turpentine and Rosin Factors Company, and his wife was a founding member of the Jacksonville Symphony. This house features interesting pattern shingles as well as unusual quadrant windows on the upper story.
The house at 1702 Osceola on the corner of Riverside Avenue was built in 1913 for lumberman J.D. Sass. From 1931 to 1946, it was the home of John W. Martin, who served as mayor of Jacksonville for 3 terms and as governor of Florida from 1925 to 1929. The house was condemned in 1987 and was destined for demolition when Riverside Avondale Preservation and the neighborhood banded together to protest the planned construction of an ambulatory eye clinic on the site. The house has since been extensively remodeled.
As you turn around and head back toward the river, to the corner of St. John's Avenue, you may be interested to know that the Sass House is notable for more than just its architecture. Fans of a certain famous homegrown band know it as the erstwhile real estate office of Mr. Leonard Skinner. Skinner was the former Robert E. Lee High School gym coach, later turned realtor, who repeatedly punished musicians Gary Rosington and Bob Burns for breaking the school's strict dress code, which didn't allow boys to have long hair touching the collar or sideburns below the ear. Their mocking tribute was to name their new rock band after him. As the fame of the band Leonard Skinner grew, so did Mr. Skinner's problems with people stealing his real estate signs.
Tony, that's not the only band from Jacksonville, right?
No, there's plenty of famous bands from Jacksonville. In fact, there's a lot that are from Riverside.
Yeah, well, there's Molly Hatchet.
Sure, and then
Allman Brothers.
The Allman Brothers played their first concert, reportedly, at Willow Branch Park. And now there's a lot of bands that are famous, that like the Black Kids and Red Jumpsuit Apparatus, where many, if not all, of their band members are from Riverside.
There must be something in the water.
I guess so.
On the left, at 2263 St. John's Avenue, is a well-proportioned yellow brick prairie school structure designed and built by Henry Taylor and Sons in 1919. It sports a green tile roof and full-width porch. Its regular groupings of 3 windows, a hallmark of the prairie style, add to its horizontal emphasis. Mr. Leon Cheek, of Cheek Castle fame, lived here for 10 years before building his home on the river. When he vacated this house, his brother, CEO of the Family Coffee Company, moved in. Please take a left onto St. John's. With a couple of exceptions, you'll notice that the homes along this stretch of St. John's Avenue are much more modest than the River Boulevard counterparts. They're characteristic of the homes constructed to house the builders and entrepreneurs that flocked to the city after the Great Fire. This blend of unassuming houses set alongside grand mansions is repeated throughout Riverside Avondale and signifies the architectural and socioeconomic diversity that is much treasured by the area's residents.
At 2245 St. John's, you'll see a house that borrows from classical and colonial revival elements, but doesn't fit squarely into either architectural style. This blending of styles is fairly typical in Riverside, where the majority of homes were designed not by architects, but by builders and craftsmen. By choosing bits and pieces of popular architectural elements and mixing them together to suit their own needs, local artisans were able to create homes that were responsive to and reflective of the sensibilities of the growing middle class. This particular house was built in 1920, but the architect and builder remain an unknown.
The house on your right, number 2244, is a masonry structure that, like the previous one, is a blend of several different styles. This particular house, built in 1922 at a cost of $8,890, was constructed for Dr. Edward Jelks, a prominent physician and one of the founders of Riverside Hospital. The bricks used to build the home were a wedding present from Dr. Jelks' father-in-law.
At 2236 St. John's, you'll see one of the many structures that were built and still used as apartment houses. This particular structure, built in 1913, borrows from an array of Mediterranean elements. Multifamily residential buildings began appearing throughout Riverside in the 1910s and 1920s in response to population increases. Most were duplex and quadruplex units of either frame or masonry vernacular construction and generally featured two stories with either one or two-story verandas and hip roofs. Another apartment building a few blocks down at number 2119 St. John's is Gertrude, the twin of the U-shaped structure we first saw on River Boulevard.
Look across the street at 2231 St. John's. It's a modest house built in 1920 that shares a basic boxy form with countless other homes around the country. When built, such homes didn't aspire to a particular architectural style. Simply put, the square shape was economical and suitable for small city lots, while still providing roomy interiors. However, that hasn't stopped folks from trying to give the shape a name anyway, often with amusingly regional results. In Colorado, this would be considered a Denver box. In Seattle, a Classic Box, and in Kansas and Iowa, the Corn Belt Cube. In 1982, it was decisively dubbed the American Foursquare, although this is essentially an invented style and a made-up name, coined by an enthusiast who wanted to take a common building and give it a defining feature. As architectural historian Wayne Wood has stated rather memorably, everybody wants their house to have a style, but most houses don't have one.
The multi-unit apartment home on your left at number 2223 was built in 1935 in the Tudor Revival style. This style first became popular in America during the first three decades of the 20th century and was very loosely based on architecture of early 16th century Tudor England and a variety of medieval English prototypes ranging from thatch roof folk cottages to grand manor houses. Homes in the style are typically clad in brick or stucco in combination with wood half-timbering and feature steeply pitched gables with little overhang at the eaves.
As we approach Copeland Street, you'll notice on your right a charming wooden house with a side porch at number 2210. This house, designed in 1922 by Marsh and Saxelby, was once the home of Frank Slaughter, one of Florida's most prolific novelists. Slaughter began writing in 1935 while still a physician at Riverside Hospital, paying off a $60 typewriter at $5 a month. Several of his semi-autobiographical novels became films, including his most famous book, Doctor's Wives. That the famed firm of Marsh and Saxelby was involved in designing such a relatively modest house is a testament to the variety and prolific output of this architectural firm, a partnership between William Mulford Marsh and Harold Saxelby that lasted 27 years. Many of the elaborate residential designs found in San Marco, San Jose Estates, Avondale, and Ortega are attributed to Marsh and Saxelby, including the Grand Estate at Epping Forest.
This house is characterized as a raised bungalow and is a 2.5-story structure with a basement that is partially above ground and lit by ground-level windows. Popularized by magazines of the era and touted for their functional simplicity, bungalows are an all-American housing type that was designed and built in great numbers after the turn of the century. Featuring a space-efficient floor plan, bungalows typically cluster the kitchen, dining area, bedrooms, and bathroom around a central living space. Although elements were often borrowed from other styles, the basic plan of a bungalow is fairly consistent. It has 1.5 stories with a gently pitched gable usually facing the street. There's always a porch, often sheltered by a secondary gable and supported by tapered piers. The bungalow, in its many variations, is the most common architectural style in Riverside, comprising almost 60% of the houses. In fact, Riverside Avondale has more bungalows than any other neighborhood in the state.
Pause a moment at the corner of Copeland and Oak. On the near corner at 1804 Copeland, you'll find an attractive prairie-style house built by E.E. Garswood in 1913. Seeing it today, one wouldn't guess that by the 1980s, the house had been transformed into a therapy facility for crippled children. Now it has been completely renovated and is occupied as a private residence and bed and breakfast. Take a minute to admire the beautiful English garden with its flowering beds, fountains, jasmine-covered swing, and brick pathways.
Cross the street to the opposite corner of Copeland. At number 1805 is an impressive prairie-style home built by Ransom Buffalo for William P. Baldwin in 1919. Mr. Baldwin was vice president of the Baldwin Levi's Naval Stores Company. Ransom Buffalo's career, as noted in the book, Jacksonville's Architectural Heritage, is something of a puzzle. A self-made man with only a seventh-grade education, Buffalo came to Jacksonville in 1910 and advertised himself as a builder and designer, but never referred to himself as an architect. He designed and built a number of fine houses in Riverside in the prairie style, a majority of them after World War I, when the style was being abandoned by most local and national architects. No one is quite sure how the North Carolina native got exposed to or why he became so absorbed by the concepts in the aesthetic of Sullivan, Wright, and Clouthot. However, the house at 1805 is thought to be one of Buffalo's best prairie school designs.
Please take a left on Copeland and walk along the right sidewalk toward Riverside Avenue. On the left corner, you'll see the Fenimore Apartments, which Mellon Greeley designed for local merchant-turned-developer Clarence Doty. There were a few apartment buildings in Jacksonville before 1910. The concept of apartment living, which had originated in northern cities, was only gradually catching on in the South, in part because private property ownership was such a fundamental precept of the Southern architectural heritage. However, the success of the Sangeline Apartments, built in 1916 on Memorial Park, opened up a new era of apartment buildings designed for luxurious living, and the Fenimore, constructed in 1922, was designed to be one of Jacksonville's most elegant multifamily residences. The structure, with its distinctive dark brick and contrasting concrete balconies, tiles, and lintels, was originally planned as a two-story building. The final three-story version was built at a cost of $90,000. The name is said to have been taken from James Fenimore Cooper, whose romantic tales of the American frontier were hugely popular at the time. The Fenimore became the first home for many of Jacksonville's prominent newlyweds. According to one social authority of the era, everyone spent their honeymoon at the Fenimore.
Please cross Riverside Avenue and continue up Copeland. We have now left the St. John's Quarter and walking toward the area that contains some of the older remaining houses in Riverside. At the top of the street, on your right, you'll see a large Tudor-style house known as the House of Many Gables. It was built in 1901 and featured a sprawling front yard that stretched all the way down to Riverside Avenue. The apartment house to your immediate right now occupies the site of the once elaborate gardens. This was once the home of prominent architect Arthur Gilkes. A New York native, Gilkes established his firm in Jacksonville in 1896. By 1907, a national publication identifying 10 of Jacksonville's finest houses noted that Gilkes had designed 5 of them, including this one. As a city of fine residences, the article reported, Jacksonville is fast becoming distinctive and is at present hardly surpassed by any other of the southern cities. When the house was new, there was no bulkhead on the St. John's, and heavy rains would often cause the river to overflow all the way to Oak Street. This created swampy conditions that help explain why the family christened the house Frogmore. It was a tribute, Gilkey's daughter once noted, to the persistent chorus of frogs that often kept the family from sleeping at night.
As you reach Oak Street, you'll have a fine view of 1630 Copeland, the impressive Colonial Revival structure located on the opposite left corner. The Colonial Revival style, which typically featured symmetrical facades, classical detailing, and towering columned porches, suggests power and establishment, which is why it was the preferred architectural style of many affluent citizens at the turn of the century. Here in the South, we tend to think of this as the plantation style. The house was constructed in 1906 for J.E. Johnson, president of the Realty Title and Trust Company, and features glossy pine floors, gorgeous cypress paneling, wainscoting, and elaborate carved moldings. By the 1970s, the house had fallen on hard times and was a boarding house. One resident who lived there at the time fondly recalls the group of gentlemen boarders who made a habit of coming down to dinner in drag. After the owner lost the house, it sat empty for several years and then became a bed and breakfast, reflecting a pattern of commercial rezoning that was repeated throughout this part of Riverside. Turn right and proceed down Oak Street toward Goodwin.
The home on the left side of the street at 2165 Oak Street was built for the president of Our Home Life Insurance Company in 1910.
It represents another variation on the style that swept through Riverside at this time. It's a sort of diluted Queen Anne style with the asymmetrical massing typical of Queen Anne architecture, but without most of the familiar Victorian frills. Note the highly textured block retaining wall. Here, concrete block has been formed to replicate the look of rough stone. Stone embankments are common on houses between the river and Herschel Street. They serve to elevate houses above the frequent flooding of the St. John's River prior to the bulkheading of the riverfront. Continue strolling toward Oak Street. The remaining homes along this block together help illustrate how changes to Jacksonville's zoning regulations back in 1968 created conditions that nearly destroyed Riverside.
In the 1950s and 1960s, people began to move outward to more distant suburbs. The old neighborhoods with their once stately architecture began to deteriorate and become commercialized. Prime development surged west, and the earliest fringe of the district succumbed to decay and even demolition as local hospitals expanded and looked for additional space. As older families moved on, their homes were often converted into rental property or simply demolished to make way for business growth downtown. Seeing these problems, earnest city planners determined that the best way to fix struggling historic neighborhoods was to turn them into commercial zones that would attract new development. During Jacksonville's 1968 consolidation, huge swaths of Riverside were rezoned for commercial use. Unfortunately, the rezoning only exacerbated the problems it was intended to reverse. The adverse zoning meant single-family residential houses were no longer deemed the highest and best use of the land. As a result, most of the houses you're walking past switch from single-family to multifamily and business uses, and most of them have the scars to prove it.
On your left at 2137 Oak Street, you'll see a brown blob of a structure that looks like some metal trailer boxes were haphazardly stacked on the front of a building and then stuccoed over to create the pretense of cohesion. When first built, probably in the first decade of the last century, this was an attractive wood-framed single-family home. Indeed, you can still see the faintest hint of what it must have looked like if you peer at the upper left corner of the building. After the municipal rezoning, speculators bought up the house and determined it was far more profitable to convert it into an apartment building, a use that persists today. And yet, as the next house on your right illustrates, other structures have survived such conversions and managed to retain the architectural details that made them unique.
At 2120 Oak, you'll find a three-story Colonial Revival brick and shingled house that was built in 1910 for M.B.R. Nixon, an attorney. By the 1940s, it had become one of Jacksonville's last tourist houses. Then, in the 1970s, it was converted for use as a 12-unit apartment building. It could all too easily have met the same unfortunate fate as its neighbor across the street. And yet, happily, it hasn't. When a local law firm eventually took over the property, it undertook an extensive restoration that in 2004 won a Jacksonville Preservation Award. Even though the building still serves as a business, its owners were careful to retain the house's domestic features, which in turn helped preserve the residential ambiance of the street. The result is a lovely building, now a century old, which is a vibrant example of how businesses and homes can peacefully coexist.
The same is true for the three-story frame vernacular home next door at 2114 Oak Street. It was built in 1902 as a private residence for William N. Angus, a Jacksonville entrepreneur. The home once enjoyed a very large lot on Riverside Avenue and had unobstructed views of the St. John's River. Unfortunately, over the years, the property was divided and sold. The house was turned into an 8-unit apartment complex, and then an addition was placed on the original front of the property to add even more units. The present owners purchased the house in 2000 and launched a painstaking restoration. At the time, there were no known photographs of the original home. They were able to locate evidence of a wraparound porch within the covered walls and recreate the entrance on the opposite side of the house. When they later received a 1905 photo of the house from the granddaughter of the owner, they were thrilled to see that the wraparound porch they had recreated on Oak Street looked exactly like the original wraparound porch that once faced Riverside.
As you cross Goodwin to the corner of Oak, look to your right at the granite curbs lining the right side of Goodwin Street. These originally served as ballast for the ships that frequented the busy Jacksonville ports. When the ships took on their cargo, they would unload the granite, which you see repurposed here. As you reach the corner, look to the opposite corner for the exotic and heavily ornamented pink building at number 2063 Oak. This building, one of Clutho's masterpieces, was built in 1926 in the Mediterranean Revival style. The building is five-sided with the main entrance facing the intersection. Its most outstanding feature is the arcaded front porch and columned balcony, both with hexagonal columns with ornate capitals. The house was built for Dr. James Love and Dr. R. H. McGinnis, who worked in their offices on the first floor and lived above on the second floor. The doctors had separate apartments, but shared a common kitchen and dining room.
The house was vacant and destined for the wrecking ball when Tom Neal, a local truck dealer, purchased the building in 1970s. After using the building for business purposes, Neal became the first owner in our area to secure federal tax credits in exchange for granting a facade easement to Riverside Avondale Preservation. The easement, which is binding on all future owners, ensures that the building's facade will not be altered and that its intrinsic historical and architectural values will be preserved. The Love McGinnis House has been recognized by the Jacksonville Historic Landmarks Commission as one of the 100 most historical and architecturally significant structures in Duval County.
Behind and to the left of the Love McGinnis home, you'll notice a large, attractive complex. This is a new condominium building, completed in 2007, which has won multiple awards for its prairie-influenced architecture and sensitive approach to infill development. This building and the others you'll pass while walking along Oak Street toward Margaret Street represents the newest addition to our ever-evolving neighborhood. Even in an historic district listed in the National Register of Historic Places, change is inevitable, as is the challenge of balancing preservation with progress. When historic buildings are allowed to deteriorate or torn down, or when our historical street grid is eliminated, a part of our past disappears forever. But living, breathing neighborhoods cannot and should not be static. And if approached with sensitivity, infill commercial construction can bring renewed energy and valuable services to the urban corridors where most of our historic building stock is located. RAP has worked hard with developers in recent years to ensure that these new buildings promote good design and respect the essential character of the district. For example, the shops on your left line the street in a pedestrian-friendly manner with their surface parking tucked to the side and back of the development.
To your right stands Riverside Square, completed in 2002. This shopping center was the first modern retail center in the city to incorporate an urban design layout that sought to interact with its surroundings. Among the design concessions made in this award-winning development was to build the Public Store at the back of the property along Goodwin Street and to construct street-front retail with plazas that mirror nearby Memorial Park. While the buildings don't attempt to mimic the architecture of the neighborhood, they clearly are in sympathy with it and respect the scale of the surrounding structures. Ironically, Riverside Square stands on the site of what was once Riverside Hospital, which served the area for 85 years before being demolished. Just as Riverside Hospital's expansion needs prompted the demolition of the seminal Clutho House at 2059 Riverside, so too did the hospital fall to bulldozers to make way for Riverside Square, a quirk of fate that Wayne Wood attributes to Clutho's angry ghost.
Beyond the Publix parking lot on Riverside Avenue, you'll see the pale peach buildings that comprise the Villas of St. John's, a 258-unit riverfront apartment community built on the site of the long-vacant All Saints Nursing Home. You walk past these buildings at the outset of the tour. Although local residents complain, with some justification, that the new building with its large parking garage at Wedding Memorial Park is out of scale with the neighborhood, the building which previously occupied the site, the All Saints Nursing Home, had become an eyesore and a property hazard. As you reach the corner of Oak and Margaret Streets, you're in the heart of a bustling, mixed-use district that is vastly different from the Riverside of the past. Pause here. Ahead of you is the condo complex at 1661 Riverside, built on the site of a 1957 Taylor Hardwick-designed single-story office building, which itself was constructed atop the remnants of houses from Riverside's legendary row.
Fortunately, echoes of the neighborhood's past are still clearly evident. To your right, you'll see the Majestic Park Lane, a 17-story apartment building that was Riverside's first high-rise. The tower caused quite a stir when it was built in 1926 at a cost of $800,000. Roy Benjamin, who designed the splendid Cheek Castle, was a supervising architect for the building, which was originally built as co-op apartments. This huge structure was built on a narrow tract of land, which formerly was the front yard of a two-story brick house that still stands just a few feet away from the bottom of the park lane. The park lane's original windows were rather small. However, in the 1980s, when a truckload of termite-infested British antiques was delivered to one of the building's residents, the termites unfortunately found much to enjoy at the park lane. The entire building had to be tinted twice, and the wholesale replacement of windows that was eventually required allowed the new windows to be extended for improved river views. Note how Roy Benjamin designed the balustrade that runs along the park lane's terraces to echo Memorial Park's balustrade fronting the river.
And of course, at the end of Margaret, along the river is the iconic Memorial Park, where we started our tour. In 1918, the Jacksonville Rotary Club proposed the idea for a park to honor the 1,200 Floridians who perished in World War I, and the city purchased the property in 1919. 31 civic groups worked in planning and raising funds for the park, which was dedicated Christmas Day, 1924. The popular and much-loved park is a perfect oval of open grass set within a promenade marked by stone balustrades and a ring of live oak trees. It was designed by the Olmsted brothers, sons of the famed landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, who, among other commissions, planned New York's famed Central Park. The park features the bronze sculpture Life, created by the celebrated artist Charles Adrian Pillars. A local resident for 26 years, he also created Florida's two statues residing in National Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. In 1997, a tornado devastated much of the park's grounds. Dozens of towering live oak trees were lost. But with the help of the Memorial Park Association, RAP and the city have worked steadfastly to restore and preserve this historic landmark.
Our walking tour has now come to its conclusion, but we want you to continue walking and exploring our unique neighborhood on your own terms. You've got two routes that you can take to get you back to the Riverside Arts Market. The first would be to walk toward Memorial Park and return along the path you took from the market. If you select this option, be sure to stop in at the Cummer Museum and take a long look at its terrific collection. While you're there, check out the incredible Cummer Oak. Your second option is to dive into the bustling heart of Riverside. If you want to grab a bite to eat or shop in unique stores found only in Riverside, take a left and walk up Margaret Street toward Park Street. There you'll discover the funky 1920s era shopping district known as Five Points, named for where Park, Margaret, and Lomax Street come together from five opposing directions. The intersection that confuses so many local drivers is the enduring legacy of boundary lines where two old plantations once met.
Five Points contains some terrific independent boutiques, great dining and drinking options, and Jacksonville's first talkie movie theater, where first-run film and art house offerings are still being screened to this day.
When you're ready to return to RAM, just continue up Park Street, past Post Street. This route will take you alongside the historic Riverside Park, the city's second oldest. Take a right at Riverside Park Road, formerly Fisk Street, and you'll end up back at Riverside Avenue within a block of RAM.
One benefit of taking this route is that on the left side of Riverside Park Road, you'll pass the beautiful Ernest Ricker House, built in 1896. It's Riverside's best remaining example of Queen Anne architecture.
As for this audio tour, we sincerely hope you've enjoyed it. As with any enterprise analyzing the history and unique architecture of our city, the information presented here draws heavily from the outstanding work done by Dr. Wayne Wood, who founded Riverside Avondale Preservation in 1974. Elaine Starling, RAP member and chairperson of Riverside Bus Tours, and her group of volunteers also contributed numerous significant details as well as much valued advice.
We hope this brief tour has helped you to better understand the philosophy that underlies an organization like RAP. We believe that architecture is more than the design of buildings. It is an enduring record of the customs, craftsmanship, lifestyles, technology, and personalities of our society. To a greater extent than any other art form, architecture is an aspect of our culture with which we must live every day. We are surrounded by it. We live in it. And we should all do our part to preserve it, not only for ourselves, but for those who will come after us.
So we'd like to thank the Florida Times Union for allowing us to record this walking tour in their studios.
And for making it available from their site, jacksonville.com.